I'm hot off the cinema.
You're hot off the cinema?
I'm hot off the cinema.
Was it hot? Are you still hot now?
I saw The Holdovers, directed by Alexander Payne.
Paul Giamatti. It's shining in the Oscar rays.
Well, by the time this episode comes out, won't that have been and gone?
It will have been and gone, but it will only have been a couple of weeks ago.
Let me call it now.
Uh-huh.
It ain't winning nothing.
Okay. Because it's nominated for, I think, 5 or something.
It's sturdy, The Offering, everywhere. And I think, like this film, it's very sturdy. It's sturdy pain. This film should be making me cry.
Right.
And there's a point where two points where it should be having me, I should be in floods of tears. And it doesn't get that killer blow in. Do you want, I've already written a very, 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 very funny Letterboxd review.
Well, you should get that ready and read it to me. And just in the meantime, as you do that, I'll tell the audience that The Holdovers is nominated in the Best Picture category and Paul Giamatti is nominated in the Best Actor in a Leading Role category. I think there are others, but those are the two mainies.
He's very good.
Davina Joy Randolph.
She's
nominated in Best Supporting.
She might get the Best Supporting. You know how you've got your theory about no one cares about the actors. They just give a... That means if anyone wins in the actors' nom, but they don't win in a film, it means nice acting, but not a good film.
No, not technically. My theory, just to be clear, because it's important to be clear with these things, isn't it?
It is.
My theory is that if a film has nominations in acting categories, but no nominations in broader categories, that's when. Whereas The Holdovers is nominated for Best Picture. And it also does appear, I think, in original screenplay, and it has an acting one. So this is a more of a general thing.
Thank you. Thank you for specifying, because I misunderstood.
Let me tell you, the specific films that we would talk about for this year, for my theory, would be Naiad, Annette Bening's film, whichever one.
Swimming.
Swimming.
That's as much as I know about that one.
And then Coleman Domingo, who's nominated for a film called Rustin, which I haven't heard of, which doesn't seem to appear in any of the other... So those are the acting performance films.
Right. Yeah, no, thank you for clarifying. And I think it's a good...
You're welcome.
Pain is pain. He's got cred, so he's a cred nom.
For Pain, we're talking... Not just The Holdovers, we're talking Sideways, The Descendants, Election, Nebraska.
Well-earned cred,
yeah.
I love Election. Sideways is... watched that many, many, many a time.
It's terrifically depressing.
It's time to rewatch. It's time for me to revisit. I haven't seen that.
Do you think so?
I haven't rewatched it in a long time. And
I watched that as a teenager, and I was convinced that's what my adult life was going to be like. I thought this has to be the most truthful depiction of an adult life that I haven't yet experienced. But this is it, right? All the other films, they're lying to me, and this one's telling me the truth.
But that's the fantastic trick he plays with, and he also plays it with The Holdovers, that there's a certain truth about the sadness of life and the failure that he deals with. But he also presents character arcs. There are breakthroughs that do happen in real life, but I'm still convinced that don't really happen in real life.
I can't wait for you to have one of yours and then for it to change everything.
I won't say what the breakthrough is in Holdovers, but the great breakthrough in Sideways at the end, when he's been saving that bottle of wine, it's all kind of gone wrong, and then he just has this, he chugs from the bottle of wine whilst having like a McDonald's, and it just speaks to the character's growth. Fantastic. Where's my moment where I get to do that?
When do you get to chug a bottle of expensive wine?
Well, when do I get, what's the thing that represents me growing as a person? And then that also sticking, you know, that character growth, I've grown so many times and then I've shriveled so soon after. And the wonderful thing about Alexander Payne movies is that you feel that there's the reality to them. And there's yearning and sadness. And then, yes, you know, these cantankerous, sad people, they can have moments of realization.
And those moments never feel Hollywoodized or out of proportion, right? You always feel as though they are moments of catharsis in between vast swathes of normalcy.
Yeah, they're so downbeat. Downbeat.
They're catharsis. Downbeat and proportionate.
Right. I don't even have downbeat catharsis.
Right.
I just have false catharsis after false catharsis. Anyway, I don't want to make this about me. My point is, this film didn't make me... Holdovers didn't make me cry. It should have made me cry.
Question.
Yes.
Did you go in expecting to at least challenge some tears?
No. Absolutely not.
Did you not? You didn't go in with an understanding. So it was only after you'd watched the film and thought those were the moments where I might have had an emotional climax, but I didn't.
No, I was about, there was a bit where I was about to pop.
What was the language we used around that again? It got you going, but it didn't start you off.
It opened,
what was it?
Got me juiced up, maybe.
It opened Papa's doorway, but it wasn't.
I tell you what it did. It kind of opened Father's cupboard doors. There were some cupboard doors left ajar.
Yeah.
And that was it.
Old dusty packets of rice and tea bags. But you didn't see a potato or anything living.
There was nothing spilled out of the cupboards.
No.
There was no doorway. The doorway was firmly shut. And that's not the film's fault. That's my... I play my part.
I was going to say, that's your fault.
I play my part in that, but I'm saying I also think the film had this potential to get me going. But maybe Payne wasn't interested in getting me going in that
maybe
regard.
Maybe Payne's not interested in you. Maybe there's a different person he's interested in.
I don't think anyone's crying at this film.
Okay.
Anyone.
Well, I'm going to watch it and see. Well, let's see what happens.
Adam is the host now. The dynamic works better when Adam is the host. Adam prefers to the host. And Joe prefers to the participant. It's better overall when Adam is the host, and Joe is the participant. Let it never be spoken of again. The ghost. 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 The ghost.
Hello, and welcome to the Movies You Forgot podcast with me, your host, Adam Richmond, and joining me as ever is the leakiest of buckets. I don't know how many times I can say this. It's like he's gone to the shop. Every time he's gone to the shop to have his bucket, buy a new bucket, and for some reason they just keep giving him one full of holes, and he doesn't even care. He pops it on the old brain. Fuck this. We'll just go. And joining me as ever is Joe Devine.
Hello.
Hello, how's it going?
Pretty good, man. How are you?
Yep, fine. This is the show in which we chat about movies we'd forgot we'd even seen in the first place. On today's episode, we are doing A Dangerous Method. It's the 2011 David Cronenberg-directed flick based on the play The Talking Cure, starring Michelle Fassbender, Keira Knightley and Viggo Mortensen, Papa Mortensen, as we like to call him.
Papa Mortensen.
It's a 99-min flick, which I don't hugely mind. I think that's spot on for this. I think if someone's making this film now, they're making it 120.
Minimum.
Minimum.
I'd say 135.
Fair play. And let us go to the letterboxed summary. Why deny what you desire the most? Seduced by the challenge of an impossible case, the driven Dr. Carl Jung, played by Michael Fassbender, takes the unbalanced yet beautiful Sabina Spielrein, played by Keira Knightley, as his patient. Jung's weapon is the method of his master, the renowned Sigmund Freud, Viggo Mortensen. Both men fall under Sabina's spell. That last line is absolute horseshit.
Yeah, that's not true. That doesn't really happen in the film. That's what would happen in the shit version of this film.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying this film is excellent or anything, but that's what an ordinary audience member expects to occur. And that does not occur. And that's one of the things that I like about it.
And that is tried to sex up. The film is sort of sexy, and that's trying to sex it up, and then also
that's having sex that's not there,
and but also making it like Sabina, played by Keira Knightley, like she's this little sauce pot who's going to get, she's a ball, and she's going to be batted back and forward between these two great minds of psychiatry.
These great thinkers. Well, what does it describe her as? It's unsettled but beautiful, you know. The two times that she's referenced in the blurb there, one references what she looks like, and the other one references that she gets bounced backwards and forwards like a little tennis ball, even though that's not true at all.
She's the bouncer.
She's the only one holding a racket.
This is adapted from a play called The Talking Cure by Christopher Hampton. Fun fact, Joe,
mm-hmm.
He'd written this years before as a screenplay with a view to getting Julia Roberts in as Sabina. And I think it was more about Sabina. That never happened. I'm very glad it didn't. This is well beyond Julia Roberts's wherewithal.
You think so?
Oh, absolutely.
Julia's not, she's not made an appearance on the Movies You Forgot podcast yet, I don't believe.
Yeah, no, let's not say any of the films, but I think she could easily slot in there.
She could slot in, and I wouldn't mind her slotting in, because I feel very confident about her range in a way that you appear not to.
I'm confident she has a range. I just think it's quite narrow.
Right.
And whenever
right.
she's tried, it's wide angle. Whenever she's tried to step out of her range, boy, has she embarrassed herself.
Well, we'll come back to this.
My point is, I think that's fun. And then he turned it into a play because no one wanted to make it as a movie. It doesn't seem like much of a movie. And then,
so might as well make it a play. Some people will see it. That's it.
Yeah. Ralph Fiennes. He's young on the stage.
Oh, really?
Ralph Fiennes.
Oh, mate.
Your
I think
mate.
if we were going to recast the movie, I would have put Ralph Fiennes in one of the roles. I probably would have put him in Freud's role. But then I suppose when this happened, he probably was more of a young.
He was more of a young. He was
a little younger.
Oh, damn you for beating me to the punch. It is very much a... Is it... I was going to say, oh, it was like, oh, this is such a play watching the film, but it kind of isn't. I can't like work it.
It is a play.
Yeah.
It's a play for sure.
Well, there's a
it's
lot.
It's got three characters in it. You don't need any more. It's got half of the wife. You get a half for the wife. It's fine. You do it all in two different sets. One of the sets is in Vienna. Is it Vienna they're in or Venice? Vienna?
Would you agree with the notion that generally plays don't tend to make good movies?
I would agree that a lot of the time they don't make good films unless the correct adaptation occurs. But I don't agree with it as a blanket statement. I think there are several plays that have made really good films.
They do. They have. So there's 12 Angry Men, Closer, Glengarry Glen Ross.
Your favourite?
A Few Good Men was a play. I didn't think that, I didn't realise when I saw that got, was on the stage again a couple of years ago, I thought, oh my God, they'll turn anything into a play. And that's how thick I am.
Amadeus,
boom, another play.
Casablanca, one of the greatest films of all time.
Really?
Yeah.
A play.
The reason that I don't agree with it as a blanket statement, but agree sort of generally, is because all of the best Shakespeare adaptations, I think, move the story on significantly and play in the new space. You know, I think that's always the fun thing about when you see an adaptation from stage to screen. If the play's really old and has already been told numerous ways, so anything that's 100+ years old. Is particularly famous from the 20th century and has already had reruns on the stage, then the people making it are far more liable to try to adapt it and evolve it into what that would look like in the film space. Whereas if films are taken from plays that were, you know, had successful small runs, or something like Fences, for example, which was that Denzel Washington film, the film they make ends up being a kind of homage to to theatre.
Too faithful to the text.
Which is to say, small, too faithful to the text, like very monologue heavy, small sets, small feeling. And I think they're two incredibly different things. I love, you know, do you remember, did you ever watch Coriolanus? With Ralph Fiennes and
Gerard Butler. I did.
Yeah, Jerry Butler.
Yeah.
It's not a strike or anything.
It's good,
but
though.
It's certainly a spare. I enjoyed that, and like I love the aggression of it, and I like how the staging of it, and how it feels big and adventurous, and you know, people do that with Shakespeare.
Right. We've got you're bang on the notion. Play feels like it's more concerned, and it can be, it's more concerned with characters and very, 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 very concerned with dialogue, because that's all it's got. And film is, I would say, more, its strengths are imagery and plot and story.
Yeah, and tone.
Okay, yeah.
It's easier to create tone in film than it is on the stage.
I'm getting bogged down. What I'm saying is I don't go to the theatre that much anymore. I don't like the crowds because they like to pat themselves on the back and go, we're at the theatre.
It does feel good to be at the theatre, though. But it's one of the reasons I like it, because I grew up half of my time as a teenager in London at a family pub theatre that is the property of my uncle. And so I watched all kinds of shit over the years. I mean, really, some really awful, dreadful stuff. Only a small little 60-seat theatre. But I grew up around all people that would come in on a three-week basis. They'd come and do a run for 3 weeks, and then they'd do a quick get-out and get in. It was very interesting to be in that environment, both as a child and then also as a young man working behind the bar, you know, to be exposed to these arty types for a three-week period, a very intense three-week period, where you were the backdrop to those people, either, you know, range of just doing their normal job, if they were a successful jobbing actor, doing something that was more, you know, perhaps they were slightly more amateur, but they were taking some holiday. Lots of the actors that performed in plays there were just on a break from work to do it. And it was a, you know, they loved it, so they were well into it. Young people on their way up, you know, directors who wanted to work in these smaller spaces to do stuff that was more experimental. And then spending a lot of time around them as an impressionable youth, you know, you pick up a kind of snobbery about how theatre's not supposed to have music, that you're not really supposed to show anyone anything. You're supposed to kind of, you're supposed to get it all from just theatre. Is it its best when it's just two people and an empty room, you know? And the storytelling and the power of the dialogue and the whatever, that's the thing that creates it. So there's this kind of sophistication about it, which isn't always really there, but is sort of thought to be there. And I think I've held on to that. So when I go to the theatre, I always feel thoroughly proud of myself that I'm not in the cinema, because it's still considered this higher art form, isn't it? Like, you hear actors saying it as well. My first love was the theatre, of course, and I do theatre as often as I can, or I was trained on the stage, you know. And there seems to be a sort of snobbery around actors or people who prefer screen acting or watching films, even though it is patently the case that the vast majority of people would choose movies.
Well, I think movies is harder. I mean, I think Mark Rylance is a perfect example of someone who people say is a great actor, a great theatre actor. And whenever he's been in a film, he's pretty much dog shit.
Well,
wait a minute.
Bridge of Spies.
That's the only, you, I love it. I love how I say something really thick and like very, and you always know exactly where the little fissure is in the shit thick
if
thing.
If only you were less like total about with your criticisms, you wouldn't be gettable, would you?
I don't understand what the point is. Why would you go, oh, sometimes Mark Rylance isn't very good? It's like, no. Just go for it. Let's say it. Let's say Mark Rylance. And he is, I think, generally pretty shit.
Uh-huh.
And even when I saw him in Jerusalem, I thought this was a big pantomime of a performance. And this is the play that everyone in London was
Going on about it.
But yeah, so generally, like, Mark Rylance is not a compelling or a compelling screen actor at all, compared even to someone like Ryan Reynolds.
Even in, did you watch Bones and all?
Oh, no. He's in that, isn't he? I wouldn't watch stuff with him.
Yeah, I really hated it.
And what about him?
He's very scary in it. Like, he's creepy. His character is supposed to be creepy and he plays the villain. And he does that well. He does create a creepiness. But I hated him and I hated the film. Because I didn't know what it was. It wasn't sold as a vampire-y, cannibal-y film. It was sold as a teenage sort of... No, it wasn't. Honestly, you read the blurb.
Please. Let me just find out what the blurb is.
I'm going to tell you the story. You look for the blurb in the background, and I'll tell you the story, okay? The reason I know it wasn't is because my wife and I went to see it on our first wedding anniversary because we thought it was the story of teenage love, yeah? The trailer does not include anything about eating people or vampires or whatever it is that they are. The blurb does not include, it did not when I read it. I don't care what it says now, Adam. It did not include anything about eating people.
This is the Letterboxd blurb. This will be the blurb that they ripped that's from everywhere. Abandoned by her father, a young woman embarks on a 1,000-mile odyssey through the back roads of America where she meets a disenfranchised drifter. But despite their best efforts, all roads lead back to their terrifying pasts and to a final stand that will determine whether their love can survive their otherness.
Right. What the fuck is that, mate? And this means that on our first wedding anniversary, my wife and I are in the cinema, we're laughing aloud at the climactic emotional scene within this film. We're probably ruining the time of the other people who've intentionally gone to see this because it's their thing and they're into it. And I'm laughing at how one of them is feasting lovingly on the body of the other and thinking, how is it allowed that you can have a film where the trailer and the blurb have no zero reference to the entire plot being about cannibals. It's totally, and I'm not someone who would write in to complain about things, yeah?
But
it's fine. But if I was, I would write so many letters about this incident because it is completely unacceptable to do that, okay? Just say it's cannibals.
Because you wouldn't have gone to see it then, would you?
No, I might have seen it, but I certainly wouldn't have taken my wife to go and see it on our anniversary. She's squeamish as it is.
Yeah, I mean, let's talk a little bit about the film before we get on to other bits.
Can I tell you just about... I wrote down two things about this film. There were two different lines. One of them really made me laugh.
Oh, okay.
And one of them almost made me cry. And these were the extremes of my experience. The rest of it was sort of middling, yeah? The bit that really made me laugh was Keira Knightley's character, upon sort of being broken up with by Jung, she says, "Do you not love me anymore?" And his response is, "Only as your physician." I thought that was very funny.
That's a play line.
Yeah, that's a play line.
It's great. It's a great line.
It doesn't make sense in the film.
No, it does though, because it's funny. That speaks to so much about what's going on. But it doesn't make sense
with the tone of the film, is what I'm saying. Like, it made me think that there's a much, much better film buried within this one.
I think there probably is. But it's, that line says so much. That's very funny. Okay, yeah, good. I heard that line. I'm glad you wrote it down.
Great. The line that nearly made me cry is the one that probably would do for anyone else of my disposition. It's towards the end of the film. Jung and Sabine are together again. She's pregnant. She's married to someone else. She's visiting his house. He's older. He seems depressed. And, you know, he's fallen out with Freud. And they're having this, they're sitting on a bench having this chat, a kind of chat to end all chats, you know. And within that chat, he says, "My love for you was the most important thing in my life. And I think that's a fucking great line as well, man. That's a really, really great line and a lovely admission, a lovely reflection. Fassbender reads it so well. It hits home in that moment.
Yeah, that's a...
Should we say? I don't know. I feel like because we've been talking for a long time about different things, we haven't really said what the film is. But like, just very briefly, the film is... Keira Knightley's character, Sabine, is having a lot of mental health difficulties at the beginning of the film. She's sent to Jung to be his patient. He treats her with using Freud's techniques and like some of his own. She recovers over time and then becomes his assistant and becomes a doctor herself. Meanwhile, Jung and Freud start to develop a relationship. And, you know, as Keira Knightley's character recovers, Jung and her Sabine, they start to have an affair. And that's basically what happens in the film.
It's why, again, well, it's definitely a play. It's not a plot heavy film at all. There is a story, but it's very subtle. There are things that are alluded to that it makes you fill in the blanks. Like, it's a very much of a, it's a grown up film, but a part of it and part of the play was to, it speaks to the Sabine Sabine in real life, her contribution to the work that Jung and Freud are
credited with. Psychoanalysis,
positions her as being fundamental to the ideas that they had about stuff.
Which sounds like it makes sense, because without getting too much into the technical nitty-gritty of it, Freud is obsessed with how everything is related to sex. Jung kind of gets a bit obsessed with like spiritual stuff that he can't prove, that Freud thinks does a disservice to the science. And she comes in the middle and goes, is it maybe not all about sex, but a bit more sciencey than what you're saying, Jung? She went in and said, is it maybe also about death as well as sex? And then people sort of agreed that it probably was.
Maybe this is a perfect way to get onto Knightley, because you WhatsApped me fairly soon after you started watching it going, oh, I forgot she does an accent for this.
Yeah.
And she's going to have to do it the whole way through. Now, listen.
Uh-huh.
I already know you're going to say horrible things.
I'm not going to say horrible things. I'm going to explain why I had a reaction.
It's interesting because about accents, you completely forgot about Natalie Portman's accent.
I did.
For V for Vendetta, and you said,
yes,
it doesn't matter. And then I was watching it through your eyes and I heard it. I think Keira Knightley does a fantastic job with this accent.
Sure, she does.
And she does... She over-eggs some of the scenes, but then there are other very difficult scenes.
There's some eggy pudding in there.
But she also plays some of them really, really wonderfully.
Yes, she
and
does.
I don't like people making fun of her. People make a lot of fun of her.
They do.
Chin acting. And as a man with a big chin, I've been on the receiving end of chin.
You think
comments.
You got a big chin?
That's what people have said.
You've been on the receiving end of chin comments.
Absolutely. I mean, not now, but...
When?
School, mate.
At school, did you have a big chin as a boy? Have you grown into your chin? I've never thought of you as a big-chinned man.
Well, ask anyone.
What do you mean, like in a sort of Johnny Bravo sense, or is it just, it's pointy?
It's pointy and it's quite... I think it's all about the distance between the chin and the lip.
Is that why you cover it up with a beard?
I don't... This isn't the time to say yes or no. No.
I just think if after a decade of friendship, if you're going to raise that you've got people... You're someone who people refer to as a big chin guy for the first time, I'm going to ask questions about it.
No, of course. No, this that was... Not now, but... I mean, people still might do it, but when you're a grown-up, they're not... You know, you don't get bullied, do you?
I bully you relentlessly. I've never bullied you about your chin.
Yeah, but I'd never bully you about being such a fucking baby face. Oh, actually, I do.
You do. Pick a thing you don't.
No, I'm not. I never call you a tubby bitch.
Yeah, but I am a tubby bitch. I don't think you've got a big chin.
Yeah, but I can't do anything about my face, you know, and there's nothing...
No, but this is... I'm just fascinated by this. That this has come out in this... It shouldn't... You know, you shouldn't forget. We're having a conversation about a film about psychoanalysis. And you're talking about your chin. I've never heard about your chin before. I've never thought anything of your chin, ever.
Now it's all you'll
think about.
And
now here out comes the chin.
Now it's all you'll think about. Because I don't... It's so big, the issue in my chin.
Is it?
No.
I think your chin's totally proportionate. Have you developed a thing about your chin because of being bullied about it?
No. This is, I mean, that's so many years ago.
I know, that's, you know, that's developed over time.
Did at the time, but...
You're in your 40s now, and that chin comment just came out. That's buried there, isn't it?
No, it's not buried there. That's just texture to my frame of reference. I thought it was funny to say, and then it's not something I would... I'm going to be now because I am sensitive about it because I was made to be sensitive about it. It's why if at any time my children would ever talk about someone's physicality,
yeah,
it would
you come down on them like a ton of bricks
because it's
with that big chin of yours.
Yeah, that's a ton of chins. You can't, you know, someone can't do anything about I love ragging anyone on something that they can change. Their personality, their bookshelves, their taste. I'm going to fucking rinse you. But if it's anything to do with what they look like.
Right. Game over.
Game over. Don't do that. You know, if you can't change it, you can't make fun of it. But if you can change it, it's fair game.
Well, now, and what I think did the children say about your chin?
You what?
What did the children say about your chin?
It's just, you know, chinny. And then there
chinny?
Was, no, that, not just that. And then back in the day, there was the football commentator, Jimmy Hill. So I got, you know, I got Jimmy a lot.
Can you reach for a specific example? Do you remember anything that occurred with... Do you remember someone saying something to you?
It was all the time. It's just background at school, at secondary school. It's just background noise. It's like
you don't have to name the boys, but if you can picture one of them in particular, don't name him, but picture him in your head.
Yeah.
Think about a time when he said something to you about your chin.
Right.
And then when you've got that in your head,
yeah.
Tell us about it.
It's a complete loss of control. It's a thing you can't do anything about, and that does feed into all of my other fears and anxieties and thing and triggers. If there's a thing,
the chin is the core of it all.
I think so. It's always been. It's always spoken to. If there's a thing, if I can't do anything about it, and someone's speaking to that in any kind of critical way, it's a skewer in the guts.
Did anyone ever call you chinchilla?
No, no one was that clever. No. No, it was always just chin, chinny, Jimmy.
Jimmy Hill.
Yeah. Right. And, you know, it leaves you raw.
Wow.
It leaves you raw to stuff.
Do you know what my nickname was everywhere?
No.
Big Joe.
Right.
That was my nickname. But often, I was the only Joe.
Right.
There was no need for there to be a distinguishing precursor, but I was, you know, I'm tall as well.
You're tall
as wide,
yeah, broad,
girthy. I've got a girthy middle,
strapping,
big strapping boy, Big Joe. They called me Big Joe at rugby, you know, but I was the only Joe.
You know, would that I knew what questions to ask you now, you know, about what that means. This is why I didn't talk about it. I've never talked. I don't talk about it. Yeah.
You're talking about your chin.
Yes.
Right. So I'm just clarifying.
I don't bring it up because what good does it do? What good does therapy do? What good does it talking about your feelings? Because all it does is, it opens the doorway for someone to kick you in the fucking balls and go,
right.
Yeah, you are a chinny fucking cunt. I can't believe.
I never noticed that before.
Yeah, you are. Yeah. And do you know what?
You've been hiding it with that beard, but now you've taken the beard off, I can really see that you've got a weird chin.
And do you know what?
That you should be ashamed of.
I now don't like you. And
right.
You should be ashamed of it, and I'm surprised. I'm surprised you trusted me enough to reveal something about yourself. Because guess what? I hate you.
Well, a man's chin says a lot about the character of the man. I think you know that because a strong chin, a broad chin, not a pointy chin, but a broad, wide angle, Johnny Bravo style chin, was a desired chin by men of the West. The 20th century, because it said of you that you had a sturdy and leadership style character, you know, Whereas men with pointy chins, small little pointers, or worse yet, big pointers, like sort of witches or banana man, that sort of thing, they weren't to be trusted on account of the angular nature of their pointy chins. So I think, to be honest, it's good that you've been hiding it, because what if people don't trust you in real life?
I'm not hiding anything.
Sorry, it's just good that you've got a beard by coincidence.
It's not. Oh, you're talking about the beard?
Yeah.
Well, no, I didn't have a beard throughout my 20s.
No, that's true.
So
the theory falls flat.
I mean, what you're doing is you're lasering in on something as if I'm doing it as a... You're basically the worst therapist in the world.
I'm drawing attention to the chin.
No, you're pretending like you're making... You're like Freud. You're becoming obsessed with the chin, and everything I do is in relation to the chin. The chin is sex. You're Freud, and the chin is sex.
And your chin is sex.
And everything I do, if I grow a beard,
if I shave my beard, it becomes
about the chin. Well, guess what? It's not about... Sometimes it's about wanting to look young or look old or look different. Or
the story of Dorian Chin.
Hide yourself. Look grubby. Look not professional. You know, there are so many different reasons at different points where I've just not bothered to shave, and you're just hanging it. You're pinning it on chin.
I'm pinning the tail on the chin.
So I'm taking it on the chin.
Everything. Hey, play that game. You can't lose, can you?
Everything at the minute. Everything you're saying, I'm taking it on the chin. And inside, I'm, buckling.
That's another thing.
I've not heard this word used so much at
That's
me
actually a
for
terrific,
so long. And it's really difficult.
I think we just had a minor breakthrough here, though, because
you'd love that.
I do love that. A popular turn of phrase you just use, taking it on the chin. Now, you are historically a man with, how do I politely say it?
Thin skin.
You're a thin skinned guy.
A thin chinned guy. Yeah, why do you think I'm so thin skinned?
Because when you try to take something on the chin, it invariably bounces off at a random angle. Because on account of the pointy nature of the chin, you're unable to reflect it back in the way that a man with a broad chin would be able to. Thin chin, thin skin. I got you. Would you like to hear a joke about a chin?
What do you think? Do you think I would?
What do you call a wizard who kisses just below the chin?
Gandalf?
Gandalf always, that's the thing about Gandalf, isn't it? Like, people always talk about how he helped the hobbits and saved Middle Earth and, he was older than the whatever. But the thing they don't talk about... Just under the chin. It's a necromancer.
Right, okay. Are the necromancers like still technically wizards, do you think?
I would say so. I think necromancy is a type of magic, wizardry.
They practice necromancy.
Yeah, I think they do. Yeah. I'm just flicking through some more chin jokes here, but you wouldn't be surprised to know how many of them are about obesity,
Whoa.
See, when I was a kid, right, I was a Cronenberg kid. Yep. I was all about Cronenberg. And when I say kid, I mean a teen.
Yeah.
And it occurred to me that there were, back in the day, there were two kinds of cineast. You were either a Cronenberg kid or you were a Lynch lover.
Right.
And that was it. Those were your two, ballparks.
They are kind of set opposite each other, aren't they, in a way? I always knew them to be the two Davids. I don't like either, really. But, you know, carry on.
Well, the reason I got onto that is because I was reading something Kingsley Amis had said about grammar and people who... about good writing. And
who's Kingsley Amis?
Martin Amis's father.
Who's Martin Amis?
A famed English author.
Okay.
They're both famed English authors.
Great, great. Go, there you go. Off you pop.
And Kingsley Amis, when it came to writing...
Did he
writing,
say it or did he write it?
He might have written it.
But if he wrote it, he probably said it at some
he
point.
He said, yeah, you say he said.
Yeah.
When it comes to proper grammar and how to write, you're either a Burke or a wanker.
Mm.
Now, a Burke is someone who wouldn't know where to put an apostrophe, a possessive or otherwise. And a wanker is someone who would get hung up on all those, where the apostrophe goes, and someone fucking up and going, well, no, that, there's no, you're putting an apostrophe in 90s. What are you talking about?
Right.
So are you a Burke?
I'm a Burke, you're a wanker.
I am, absolutely. And then I thought, and then that got me to thinking, oh, there were, back in the day, you were either into Cronenberg or Lynch.
Right.
And then I think also, cinematically, I think you're either a Burke or a wanker.
Right. Cinematically, I'm definitely a Burke.
If you're a Burke, you're into, say, Steven Spielberg.
I love him. He's one of the good ones.
If you're a wanker, I was going to say Nolan, but maybe a wanker is more like Tarkovsky or something.
Right. If you're both, can you be a banker?
You can't be both. You are either a Burke or a wanker.
But what if you like... Who's all of them?
You don't, though.
Which ones... Well, no, that's true. I don't really like David Cronenberg or David Lynch. I just said that.
So you're anyway, if you're into Cronenberg or you were into Lynch, is there a modern equivalent of... you're either into... Nolan's got to be one. Like, you're either into Nolan or...
It's more like you're either into Nolan or you're not into Nolan,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
and I think that's within a certain... That it's also excluding the majority of the cinema-going public. That's within people who like films, you know, and would write that they like films about themselves somewhere. Those people either do or don't like Nolan.
Yeah, actually, scratch Nolan. So I guess both, even back when people were talking about Cronenberg or Lynch... They're already kind of in the indie art house.
I mean, isn't it Scorsese and Spielberg?
No, that's because you could have said that back in the 80s or the 90s.
Right. You can't say that now?
Think about it this way instead. Lynch is young, sort of spiritual, slightly mad.
Ethereal.
Ethereal, thinking things are connected, dreamlike, obsessed with dreams.
Right.
And Cronenberg is Freud. And I've actually got... Cronenberg is on record talking about this film, saying he is more of a Freud guy.
Right. Even though he made a film about a man turning into a fly.
Who's the modern... Is there a modern equivalent of, like, you're either this guy or this guy?
I think Paul Thomas Anderson has to be one of them.
Yeah, he has to be. You've blown me away. You've honestly, like, he's got to be one of the guys.
But I don't know enough about cinema to know who's the person that is him or...
Is it Linklater? I don't think so. I think Linklater's fallen by the wayside to some extent.
I also think if you like Paul Thomas Anderson, you can definitely... It does not exclude you from liking Linklater. What about this? It's either... Oh, I've got it. This is what it is. This is what it is.
Guadagnino.
No, you were close. You were close. It is. It's Paul Thomas Anderson or Alfonso Cuarón.
Has he done enough stuff?
Alfonso?
Alfonso? I think it's Luca Guadagnino. Guadagnino.
No, Guadagnino. Yeah.
I think it's Guadagnino.
He did Roma, Gravity,
not enough.
Children of Men, fucking done a bunch of Harry Potter films, mate.
Yeah, he might have done one art house film for Netflix, but fuck that guy. He's out of this convo. You'll get it when you get it, right? and Paul Thomas Anderson is riding a wave of...
Okay.
Wes Anderson, before he started his last series of, I'd say, post-Grand Budapest, Popel, he's stricken himself from the record. Before that, he would have worked in this.
Okay, I've got
but
it.
He's now no longer. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, now I know who it is.
It's
Paul Thomas Anderson.
Yeah,
and then it's Joel Cohen.
You mean the Coen brothers?
Yeah, but Joel Cohen.
No, it's to just say the Coen brothers.
Okay, how about this? It's Paul Thomas Anderson.
Oh, the Coen brothers.
And then it's Ang Lee.
No. It's Paul Thomas Anderson. Oh, you know what? There are a couple. There's
it is
a couple
the Coen brothers. It's Paul Thomas Anderson and the Coen brothers. It is, yeah. Or Terrence Malick.
I love this. I love how the game can crumble at every time you say someone. And I also know that you're Googling directors.
Yeah, of course I am. I'm not trying to hide that. Why do you always think I'm trying to hide it?
No, because
I'll tell
fun.
You when I'm doing it from memory. I'm very proud of when I can do it from memory.
It's for the audience. It's texture. They love to hear me get you.
The audience will know. It's Paul Thomas Anderson or Oliver Stone. No, listen.
Joe. Yeah. I just want you to take a little pause.
Okay.
I threw the gauntlet down to you. Mm-hmm. I didn't know. You stepped up to the plate where the gauntlet was, and you picked it up and you just smashed it. You knocked it out of the park. You knocked the gauntlet out of the park. And I want you to take a moment and reflect how well you did.
Thank All you. Right? And let me just say,
you did though.
I really appreciate it. And even though I had to weave through some mixed metaphors there, I can see that you meant them as a compliment.
It was absolutely meant. Because I had this waft of a notion, and you really came through for me, bud.
I breathed life into it for you.
Do you know why I was a Cronenberg boy?
I think I do know.
Oh,
but I don't want to say.
No, go and tell me.
Are you sure? After all that talk before,
as long as it doesn't relate to the thing we've been talking about for 40 minutes, for God's sake, and that is so specific, like just make it more general, but also very specific to me. Make it more specific. You can be as specific as you like,
yeah,
but just not about that.
Not about that,
because that might not keep.
It might not stay in the episode. I understand. I wasn't, and just for the record, I wasn't going to make it about that or the shape of that or anything.
Why did you allude to that then?
No. I didn't. You
were like,
did.
Are you sure?
You did.
Are you sure you are? You?
Now listen. I think I know why you're a David C over a David L. David Sear over a David Ella. And that's for two. It's a twofold reason. Ready for reason number one?
Yeah, man.
You love body horror.
Oh, body horror.
Yeah. You love body horror. You love buddy horror. You love all the different types of horror. And you like flies. That's number one. Number two, you are an incorrigible...
Pause. You saying, I like David Lynch because I like body horror. It's like saying, you like Jaws because you like sharks.
Yeah.
You like David Spielberg. All right, forget it. Carry on.
I like David S. David S is the third of the Davids. And also, what precludes someone who likes sharks from liking Jaws? You would assume that someone who likes sharks... Actually, people who like sharks probably wouldn't like Jaws because they'd say this shark is mischaracterized. Most sharks aren't like that one.
Reason two.
Reason two is that you are an incorrigible... What's the word for it? When you do the opposite of what everyone else wants.
It's when you're... That's really annoying, isn't it?
Yeah, very annoying. It is.
It's very annoying.
It's really, like, small.
It's very small and petty.
Petty. What is it? You are a contrarian.
Contrarian.
That's it. You're an incorrigible contrarian.
No, I'm not,
small and annoying...
Hey, fuck off. I'm not
exactly.
Saying no.
Thank you. Yeah, well done. Well done for playing up to it. You were taught well at school how to embrace that. And I think that's why, because everyone, all the high art people, they like Lynch because they recognize that he's the superior filmmaker and the one who's actually interested in art. Whereas all of the normal people, they like Cronenberg because he makes more interesting films that are actually watchable and aren't all highfalutin and such. Yeah.
So I'm not
and
a contrarian.
You would have naturally rejected the people in your immediate surroundings who would have been arty, hoity-toity types who would have liked Lynch. And we both know someone who likes Lynch a lot, and you would have been around a lot of people like him, and you would have gone, no, Cronenberg's better because I am small.
No, because...
Is that
because
why?
Because I want to be entertained.
Right.
I don't want to watch...
What, you didn't watch that 14-minute Netflix short with the monkey?
No.
That was... I don't get it at all. I've tried to watch Twin Peaks like 4 times, and I sort of... Do you know what's worse than not liking it?
Not getting it?
With Twin Peaks. It's just like, every time I've tried to watch it, I've thought, oh, I'm going to give it a proper go. Friends of mine, people whose opinions I respect, really rate it. So I'm going to watch it. And then I watch like an episode or two and I go, yeah, you know. And then I watch the third one and then I just go, yeah, fine. And then I just never carry on because I don't care. It's not that it's bad or anything. I just don't care.
The problem with having a pop at Lynch for a little short sidebar is because it's art in inverted commas and it's Lynch, it's bulletproof.
Yeah, it's like if you don't like it, you just don't understand it.
It's inbuilt. And it's like, oh, you know how the acting's really bad sometimes in Twin Peaks?
Sure.
Yeah, he meant that. It's supposed to be. It's supposed to be soap-like.
It's like people who would say, yeah, it's not for everyone. It's for actually a special select group of people who are chosen. You're not one of them. So don't worry about it. You enjoy Cronenberg and The Fly. It's nice, isn't it, The Fly, how he turns into half of a fly? That's nice. It's not art or anything, but it's nice. But, yeah, it's not for everyone.
The Fly is art.
And it is for everyone.
Also, that's the beauty of it. It is also a script that you could probably turn into a play because it is basically all set, not basically, it's pretty much set entirely in the flat of... Brundle, who then becomes Brundlefly. Yeah. Three characters. It's just
Brundle, who's subsequently Brundlefly.
He's subsequently Brundlefly. It's Gina Davis, Jeff Goldblum, and the kind of scuzzy boyfriend of Gina Davis, who also turns out to be kind of a nice guy in the end. It's fantastic.
Sure,
that film is.
I was pretty
super.
Bored by it, to be honest. I don't. You
oh,
know,
fuck
I don't,
off. Okay,
I
fine.
Don't care about it. What else has Cronenberg done? What else is on David C's list?
So all the early David C stuff, the body horror stuff. So there's that Shivers, Scanners, and then to a lesser extent. Dead Ringers.
Haven't seen it. Oh, that's Existence. The one that you asked me to watch as homework.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dead Ringers is the closest to stuff like A Dangerous Method, and where he's moved. There's a point where he moved away from the kind of grot of The Fly and Scanners and Videodrome. Videodrome is so good. It becomes more about. It's almost like he's not ashamed. He just doesn't want to do that body horror stuff anymore. Although, caveat, I know he's done that very recently with a very modern... a film I've not seen yet. It came out last year, which is... It feels like it's supposed to be a return to full Cronenberg body horror. And I think Viggo's in it.
Make sure you get that that caveat out there before the David Sears jump down your throat on the Letterboxd.
They'll go, yeah, I think you'll find David Cronenberg has actually done a recent body horror movie.
Yeah. The funny thing about that is, though, that the only David Sears that would leave that comment, that sort of comment, I think you'll find comment,
yeah,
they're actually David Ellers masquerading as David Sears.
They are. They because no David Sear would do that.
No.
Because I'm a David Sear and I would never do that.
You wouldn't ever do that, ever.
I would never do that.
Ever.
But there's something very visceral about that 80s Cronenberg, and it's compelling, and it's about ideas, but then he
like the idea of what if a man
turned into a fly,
was mixed with a fly,
and what if a man became so obsessed with horrifying imagery and videos, his tummy turned into a video machine.
Right.
And he could stick his hand into his tummy video machine and he could put in videos and then he could pull out a gun and his hand would be a gun. And,
yeah. Wonder where he got his ideas.
Listen, what he does is he puts it all out there for you. He's not scared of his ideas. David Lynch is scared of his ideas because it's all wafty bullshit. And he kind of goes, yeah, look, it's a man in a little, it's a little midget in a room and he's talking backwards. What does it mean?
It's like one of those dogs that does a fart and then scares itself from its fart.
Yeah. Oh, what an image. And you see, you're a Cronenberg guy because you've gone for an image and you've dared to say what the image is.
Yeah.
Cronenberg's gone, what if a guy turned into a fly? And he didn't even say that. He watched an old movie called The Fly and said, I'll fucking remake it.
That's where he gets his ideas from.
In the original Fly, I think he becomes a small fly, whereas Cronenberg dared to have giant Brundle fly.
What if he was a bigger fly?
And he shows you it, and he delivers on what that means and what it does to the characters, and he completely commits to it. And David Lynch just gives, he leaves himself a back door. His little Davy back door. Oh, I'm going to sneak out the back door here. Did I mean it? Did I not? Oh, I don't know. See you later. Bye. Fuck off.
I did like Blue Velvet, though. But I really didn't like Eraserhead.
He's never made another film like Blue Velvet, because guess what? He's incapable of doing that.
When was the last time you heard from your father?
Daddy. Let's play the box office game now for a dangerous method.
How tough is this going to be, Joe?
Tell
the audience.
Well, I don't think it's going to be that much of a toughy-wuffy. I think I'm interested to see whether you are surprised or not.
I had my pants pulled down by submarine and I feel the breeze on my bottom.
Sure. Well, at least there's not a paddle hitting your bottom very hard. But let's find out whether my deepest desire for you to get this correct will be fulfilled or not. Now, budget. What do you think? It's brackets estimated on IMDb, but I think, and it's also in euros, helpfully. So let me just convert that.
No, it's okay. I can do euros.
Yeah.
Let's do euros.
Well, the budget is in euros. The rest of it's in dollars. Budget in euros, please.
It's got quite a cast. It's David Cronenberg.
It's got a huge cast and it's crony.
It's got a corset budget.
Sure.
Never mind a hat budget.
Yeah, it's got a corset budget. It's got a paddle budget.
8 million euros.
No.
Oh, Christ.
No. It's Cronenberg. No. It's Viggo. It's Fassbender. It's Keira fucking Knightley. Come on.
Yeah, but I think, in my head, I think they're all taking a pay cut to...
If it was like some crazy random director, but it's Cronenberg, mate.
Yeah, but I don't know how much money Cronenberg's getting for this. It's not like, it's not his body horror. It's not. I guess he's coming off History of Violence and Eastern Promises, so he's shifted already.
Sure.
Okay. I can't say more than 15 million euros.
15! Ding, 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 ding.
Oh, okay.
There you go, buddy. That's perfect. What a perfect guess. Love that. You were right. Shame it was the second time. Now, listen. Opening weekend, US and Canada. Let me tell you, this film was released on November the 27th, 2011. So, heading into the winter there. Was it a winter of discontent for Cronenberg and the producers?
This is not pulling in the punters.
No,
I'm laying it on the line.
Well, the trailer's kind of... It's got a little bit of sexiness in it.
Smut. It's got a little smut. What kind of smut crowd is... Okay, let's...
And that cast, like they are a drawing cast. I agree with you that it's not pulling in the punters on the opening weekend. But, it has got Keira Knightley in it. And I think of the three of them, if they're not recognising Freud as Aragorn, then Keira Knightley is the one that's going to be the most recognisable.
But everyone who knows, people who are fans of all these people, these actors individually, Knightley, oh, I love her in Pirates, Viggo, I love you as Aragorn, Fassbender, I love you in Shame. No, he's not done Shame. I love you. Has he done X-Men by then?
I don't know about X-Men, but, you know, I like him in,
You hoped we would speak about Fassbender.
Fassbender's going to come back for sure. He's going to come back around. He's in a few forgettables.
This is not getting much. $150,000.
Very, very well done. $167,000. Oh. If we were to apply the 10% rule, you are technically just outside the allotment.
You applying a 10% rule on a figure as small as $150,000.
That is how the 10% rule works.
Okay.
Unless it's a toughy-wuffy film. And based on the accuracy of your budget guess and your guess for this, I don't think it is a toughy-wuffy. It's unfortunate when they're so small. An opening weekend US in Canada is the hardest to attain that real specific accuracy. You were so close, so close.
No. You're bang wrong, okay?
The audience know how impressive $150,000 guess.
I'm doing a victory lap.
You listen, you're welcome to do a victory lap whenever you choose to.
I'm doing one now.
What you aren't welcome is to announce that it is a victory lap. We will decide. Yeah, and I think in this instance, the audience are probably going, that's quite a good guess. I wouldn't have got that. I'm quite far off that. Even though it was outside the 10% allotment, I think it's admissible on this occasion. That's probably what some of the audience are thinking. Others of the audience are thinking, what's this cunt doing? Don't let him do a victory lap. He's wrong. He agreed the rules. And he's always, it doesn't matter how far away he is from getting it right. He always says, I nearly got that one.
And that's the beauty of me. I always say I've nearly got it. And sometimes, like a broken fucking clock, I'm right. And in this case, I'm bang on.
Right, well, you've had your victory lap. Now, let's see if you can continue the victory into gross worldwide. How do you think this did?
Modestly, very modestly.
15 million euro budget. We're going to one for one the conversion rate.
It's not making a ton of money. If it's lucky, it's going to make $15 million.
Do you want to know how many folds you were out?
Whether I say yes or no, you're just going to say anyway.
Well, then you can at least take some control of it.
I don't need control. Two I've folds. Never been in control.
You were two folds down.
Okay.
The movie made $30.5 million.
Nice.
That is pretty nice.
I'm really glad for it.
That's a sweet little, you know, that's quite a nice little, you know.
Shall we play the game where one of us reads a list of movies to catch out the other one for a movie they forgot they'd seen in the first place?
I think we should, yeah. It's your go.
It's your turn. Oh, fuck. Hail Caesar.
Nah, don't think so.
The Sisters Brothers.
I haven't seen that one.
Bringing Out the Dead.
Nope, haven't seen it.
That's a Scorsese.
Huh.
Much Forgotten. Stars Nick Cage. Green Zone.
With Matt Damon.
Matty D.
That's interesting because I always get that one confused with the one that Leo is in.
Oh, Blood Diamond.
No, not Blood Diamond. Isn't Leonardo DiCaprio in an Iraq?
Body of Lies.
Body of Lies, yeah. I always get those two films confused. I haven't forgotten Green Zone.
Can I get you on Body of Lies?
No.
I'd love to rewatch Body of Lies. That's Ridley Scott. We could have two Ridley Scotts.
I haven't forgotten Green Zone because that's the film in which they talk about the cards that
we're really good.
You're reusing the list on me again.
No, sorry.
The cards. Yeah, the cards.
Yeah.
Go on,
yeah,
move sorry. On. Add Body of Lies to your list, but you're not getting me on it this week.
The 5-year engagement.
I'm not sure what that is. What's that?
Paul Rudd, your doppelganger, Jason Segel.
I haven't seen it.
Have you not?
I don't think so. Let me take a quick look, unless it's a real deep forgot.
It's a good little picture.
Nah, I haven't seen it.
Mystery Men?
Don't know what that is.
Ben Stiller?
No.
The Ghost in the Shell remake?
With Scarlett Johansson?
Yeah.
I don't think so. I didn't love that film, but it made something of an impression on me.
We can't do Fences because you've mentioned
I will never watch Fences ever again.
Christ. Christ, Christ.
Are you running short?
No. I think you, I know you forgot you forgot it. And I want everyone to know I haven't, but you forgot this.
Okay, but the audience must know that you haven't.
Vanilla Sky.
Yeah, okay. It's been a long time since I've seen that film, and it has got lodged on the dusty, forgotten shelf, I think. So I can accept that.
You tried to get me on it because you said you had.
Yeah.
And I refuted it. Because I said it was...
I think I'm going to put my hand up here, and I have actually put my hand up in the room. I think you are going to like it less than you remember, and you think I'm going to like it more than I remember.
I rewatched it basically. I've said basically so much. I've got a bingo of words I say on this fucking podcast. Fucking jizz.
Right on there. Fucking jizz.
Fucking jizz, apropos, that's a Partridge thing,
yeah.
Gross, egregious, basically, it's fucking appalling, anyway, sorry, no, because I watched this a year and a half ago, rewatched it, having not seen it in ages, and I was pleasantly surprised.
Okay.
So that was the Dangerous Method episode. Apologies if we didn't chat loads about the movie. It didn't, it just wasn't that kind of movie. Would you recommend this movie? Let's just end, because we didn't, we barely chatted about it. If people have got this far, would you recommend it to, for people to watch?
Yeah. Yeah, probably. Yeah.
Okay. Bye. See you later.
Bye.